Council are ready. I'll call our second case for today, 09AP1252CR, State v. Chantel T. Harbor. Arguing on behalf of the defendant is Attorney Joseph E. Redding. Mr. Redding.
May it please the Court, my name is Joseph Redding of Gloyack Limited, and we represent the petitioner in this matter, Chantel Harbor. This case is about mitigating sentencing facts that are not presented at the sentencing proceeding. And what do we do about that? Specifically, the mitigating facts we're talking about are a defendant's traumatic upbringing, a defendant's drug addiction issues, and the defendant's mental health status. This court has two issues before it regarding mitigating sentencing facts. First, does a trial counsel's failure to investigate and present mitigating factors at sentencing deny a defendant of his or her constitutional rights to counsel under Strickland versus Washington? And second, can these type of mitigating sentencing facts constitute a new factor justifying modification of a sentence? In this case, Ms. Harbor pled guilty to three crimes. The court did not order a pre-sentence investigative report. Defense counsel did not present an independent pre-sentence investigative report. She was ultimately sentenced to 24 years in prison, broken down into 12 years of initial confinement, followed by 12 years of extended supervision. Post-conviction counsel was appointed. Post-conviction counsel hired Cedar Creek Family Counseling Services to prepare a post-sentencing report. And that's provided to you in your appendix, pages 141 through 149. And this report disclosed several mitigating facts, broken down into three categories. And the first category was the defendant's upbringing. And this report disclosed that Ms. Harbor was a child of a child, her own mother being 16 years of age when Ms. Harbor was born. Ms. Harbor's father denied her existence. And Ms. Harbor's mother had some addiction issues, some very serious addiction issues. And because of that, a questionable element entered into the Harbor family. Ms. Harbor's mother's boyfriend was physically abusive to her. And most of all, Ms. Harbor was sexually assaulted by this boyfriend twice when she was 12 years old. The Cedar Creek report gave a second category of mitigating sentencing facts. And that's that Ms. Harbor became addicted to drinking and drugs shortly after high school. Her past criminal history was a result of this. And she had limited drug treatment through the prison system. The third category of mitigating sentencing facts was Ms. Harbor's mental health status. And this disclosed that Ms. Harbor had been diagnosed with depression in the early 90s. And she was first diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 2007. We also discovered that Ms. Harbor had twice attempted suicide, once in 2007 and once in 2008. I believe it was the day after she was arrested for this incident. We filed a post-conviction motion asking for a new sentencing hearing based upon ineffective assistance of counsel and also asking for the sentence to be modified, arguing that the Cedar Creek report was a new factor justifying that modification. We were shot down on both avenues. The Court of Appeals, in a five-paragraph decision, denied us, and that brings us here today.
Counsel, what assures you that these are mitigating facts?
Well, the reason that we believe they're mitigating facts is they go to her character, and specifically the sexual assault goes toward the traumatic upbringing, And the jurisprudence suggests that those who have a traumatic upbringing are less deserving of punishment. So I think it's relevant from that standpoint. The drug treatment, I believe the Cedar Creek report shows that there was a 60-day treatment and some aftercare. The Cedar Creek report explains that Ms. Harbor had limited drug treatment and that her needs are changing and that she needs more drug treatment and that her criminal behavior stems from both the mental health issues and the drug issues. I believe the mental health factors are mitigating from the result of, this is an individual who wasn't until 2007 was diagnosed with bipolar. While it was thought that she had depression, bipolar is quite different than depression. And you can see from especially the sentencing transcripts that they're trying to get her medication right. I think there was some information about Depakote. And in the Cedar Creek report, she talks about how she didn't like Depakote because it gave her nightmares. I think the treatment for the bipolar for the last 2 or 3 years is an experiment, and they're trying to tweak the meds.
Okay. Am I wrong in the idea that you brought this report and this information to the circuit court's attention?
It was brought to the circuit court's attention in the post-conviction proceedings.
And what did the circuit court judge say?
The circuit court said, the short answer is it doesn't matter.
The circuit court judge, that's a really short answer. But the circuit court judge basically said, I've considered all those things,
correct,
and I wouldn't have sentenced her any differently. Are you really asking us just to kind of resentence her from the Supreme Court level because we think the circuit court imposed too harsh of a sentence? Tell me what you're really, because that's how it seems to me. So the hurdle for me, I'm just being out there with you. The hurdle for me is overcoming the fact that the circuit court judge who sentenced her considered, he says, these factors at sentencing, was presented with this information shortly after sentencing, read it, and came to the same conclusion that even if I would have known all this, I wouldn't have reached a different decision. So that's the hurdle for me. Maybe not for other people, but for me.
Sure.
I've got to know why you're not just saying, court, come in and sentence her differently because we think the circuit court was too harsh.
Sure. From the ineffective assistance of counsel standpoint, I think it makes a big difference. Because the standard for ineffective assistance of counsel in relation to the prejudice prong is an objective test. And so we are not looking specifically at what the circuit court judge says, but we're looking at the reliability of the proceedings, the fundamental fairness.
But there have been a different outcome.
Correct. And I think it's important to emphasize that it's not Judge Maroney that we're concerned about in this inquiry for the ineffective assistance of counsel. We're looking at sentencing judges and what would a sentencing judge do, not necessarily Judge Maroney. And I think as guidance for this standard, I referenced the Smith case in my briefs. And the Smith case was an ineffective assistance in regards to a trial counsel failing to object to a plea agreement. And during those arguments, the state had said, hey, let's send it back and see if it made any difference to this judge, whether if that recommendation made any difference. And I believe the Smith case was very clear that that's irrelevant what that judge thinks. Rather, we're looking at the fundamental proceedings for this, the fundamental sentencing proceedings. And should we have allowed these factors at a sentencing proceeding? I guess the analogy I make is the difference in law school between a true or false test or an essay test. The essay test combines a lot of different things and puts them into a big kettle, kind of like our sentencing. Whereas a true or false test just says true or false. What Judge Maroney was applying was a true or false test. He was saying false. It doesn't make any difference here. And I believe under the ineffective assistance of counsel standards, specifically the second prong, we have to look at an essay test and the fundamental fairness of the proceedings.
Thank you. But just to be clear for the record, I think my recollection is with regard to the drug addiction, that was never presented at sentencing. Is that correct?
That is correct, although the Court of Appeals decision said it was, but I don't believe it ever. I don't believe there was anything in the record about drug use or addiction by Ms. Harbor at the sentencing hearing.
Well, for instance, on appendix page 1, petitioner's appendix page 105, the circuit court in its decision, in order denying motion for post-conviction relief states, first full paragraph, it is undisputed that a drug addiction was never mentioned at the time of sentencing to account for the defendant's behavior. However, even if the court had been aware of it, a lesser sentence would not have been imposed. And then after further discussion, he says, accordingly, even if the court had known of the extensive drug uses of addiction, the outcome of the sentencing proceeding would not have changed. So it appears the circuit court at least thought the parties, it was stipulated by the parties that drug addiction was never mentioned. Maybe that's incorrect, because I didn't go read all of the transcript. I'm just reading that decision, then I read the sentencing transcript, and I don't recall it, but I haven't gone through it with a fine-tooth comb again.
There is nothing in the sentencing transcript about Ms. Harbor's drug addiction issues other than the court making a comment that he didn't know if she was self-medicating or not.
You know, I mean, to sort of piggyback on what Justice Bradley was just saying, and what I first asked you is, how do you know drug addiction would be a mitigating factor, especially since if it was never mentioned and never really brought up? You'll look at the worksheet that the trial court filled out, and the trial court under drug and alcohol abuse, frequent prior use, treatment, never treated, under the influence, checked all mitigating factors. So assumed that she was in the mitigating range when sentencing her for drug type issues. How do you think that it'd be more mitigating with this information?
Well, I believe the sentencing worksheet is a bit inaccurate from the standpoint, we'll stay with the drug and alcohol abuse category. It says prior treatment, never treated for alcohol abuse. So the court can make a choice. It chose neither, yet checked mitigating. I guess my belief is that the sentencing sheet isn't as accurate as it should be and as we would want it to be. But my other statement is that it goes towards, this whole thing would go towards Ms. Harbor's character. And if Ms. Harbor's entire character is not presented, as it could have been, through the Cedar Creek report, then we're going to have some questions about this sentencing worksheet.
And may I follow up, Justice Ziegler, on your question? And that is, with regard to the drug use, the court actually says it would have been an aggravating factor had it been brought to the court's attention, but ultimately says it wouldn't have made a difference anyway, one way or the other. The sentencing proceeding would not have been changed. So she asks, why is this drug use mitigating rather than aggravating? Why was, if I may embellish, why was the circuit court wrong in saying it would have been an aggravating? Was that an error? Does it make a difference?
Under the new factor analysis, I think that would probably be correct. However, under the ineffective assistance of counsel area, I think it makes a difference because I don't think under ineffective assistance of counsel, the court gets to, that type of court gets to just take a look at its sentence and make a subjective determination. I think that with the ineffective assistance, we have to look at the entire proceeding and would a sentencing judge, not necessarily Judge Maroney, Would that make a difference to a reasonable judge?
Well, I have a question about the same thing, and I hope I'm looking at the right thing. Pages 108 and 109 of your brief has a worksheet, okay? Am I on the right case?
Correct.
Is this the one that the judge filled out?
This is the one the judge filled out.
Okay. The judge on this, and this was filled out when? At sentencing or right after sentencing?
The date at the top says 7/31 of 08.
Right. So is that right? This is before the motion for resentencing.
Correct. This was the date of sentencing.
So as I read it, maybe I'm reading it wrong. I never filled out one of these. It says alcohol and drug abuse, and it's marked, is a mitigating factor.
The court, if I may, Chief. Yeah, the court, so in the written opinion on page 105, says this repeated behavior, which she demonstrated over the years, would have been a major aggravating factor.
I know. That's why I'm pointing this out. Because what the judge says in the judge's decision and order denying the motion for post-conviction relief is that the familiarity with the more extensive analysis would not have caused the court to impose a lesser sentence. That's at 106. Repeated behavior is a major aggravating factor, yet the judge fills out this form otherwise. The other thing that surprised me about the form is that on page, the prior page, it says employment history. Usually employed, same employer for extended period of time, employed when offense was committed, lengthy or frequent periods of unemployment. Now, they are usually employed as inconsistent with lengthy unemployment, and they're all marked as aggravating. I would have expected that usually employed and same employer for extended period of time might have been mitigating factors of use. But, I mean, that may be up to individual judges. But I don't understand how the judge says mental and physical health and alcohol and drug abuse are mitigating, but then when there's rehearing on this, he says they're aggravating.
At the time of sentencing, the judge fills out the sentencing hearing and says how the judge considered these things. It doesn't mean that the person's usually employed when they check that. It probably means they're not usually employed, and so that's an aggravating factor, and so they check aggravating. The judge at the time of sentencing assumed that drug or alcohol issues worked to her favor. They were a mitigating factor. And so he checked mitigating. So that's how Justice Bradley's follow-up and my questions make sense with the sentencing guideline and his subsequent findings do too. Right, counsel?
Correct. But my point about the sentencing worksheet is that, and it goes back to the true or false analogy, is that I believe that some of this stuff on this worksheet is checked, which was just checked.
Well, there's some that not checked, so the judge made decisions about what
correct.
Should check or not check.
And the instructions at the top say check only mitigating or aggravating for those factors that apply.
Right. So
and very, very important, at the bottom of this worksheet, it says PSI recommendation, and he checks mitigating. Well, it's very clear in this case there was no PSI. Also, victim statement. He checked aggravating. There was no victim statement in this case. The victims didn't show up to the sentencing hearing. So my problem then is if the court then receives information from Cedar Creek and it says, hey, it wouldn't make a difference, it's very easy to do. And it's not – it makes me question the process of the sentencing, that – it's just a yes or a no rather than, hey, I'm going to take a look at all this again. And that's what Ms. Harber is asking for. She's asking for a resentencing so that a judge can sit down and develop all these facts, grab all these facts, you know, and then it would be up to this judge at that time to make a determination whether or not it's an aggravating fact, the drug treatment. I would suspect that new counsel would also come up with a a very detailed drug rehab program or a mental health program to help in the sentencing.
The judge, where's this mental health program going to be? Prison?
That's where currently.
Does the judge do that?
Pardon?
Does the judge decide that?
Not decide that.
That's right. So if this judge is sentencing the defendant to prison, mental health is irrelevant for the judge because the judge isn't going to tell the prison what to do about mental health care, right?
That is correct, although the judge did say that she should follow up with any treatment.
Well, he said that for extended supervision, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I want to know, what are you really basing your argument on? As I read the brief, you've got two arguments, don't you? One, this is a new factor. And
right.
Your other one, if I understand it right, is that it was ineffective assistance of trial counsel. Is that right?
That is correct.
Well, on ineffective assistance of counsel, maybe, and I'm not saying this is true, but maybe it's arguable that there was ineffective assistance because failure to get a PSI or failure to bring in your own report. But how do you overcome the second prong in ineffective assistance of counsel, which is that there'd be make a difference when you got the trial judge saying, doesn't matter at all, doesn't matter at all, doesn't matter at all?
Well,
how do you overcome that? I mean, you just don't have any prejudice because the judge says no.
Okay. And again, it goes back to the subjective versus the objective test. When the sentencing judge in this court, who also was the post-conviction judge, says, does it make any difference, I believe that is a subjective test. Whereas the objective test is asking about the proceedings themselves and should, and specifically, I believe the information in the Cedar Creek report deals heavily about Ms. Harber's character. And I believe there's a reasonable probability that a sentencing court, if they get all this information, and I understand a court could take the drug thing one way or the other, but with the mental health issues and the traumatic upbringing, I think there's a reasonable probability that a sentencing court would give a different sentence.
What do you think the sentencing would be?
That I don't know.
Did the defense counsel have a suggestion for what the sentence
would be? He did. He was asking for 10 years, 5 in, 5 out.
5 and 5.
But I think under the ineffective assistance claim, that's not something I can even argue. All I have to argue is whether or not it's reasonably probable, but for counsel's errors, the results would have been different. And I think the Pote case is a case that I cited, talks about that, and is a good example where it says, you know, hey, listen, here's a – now, granted, Pote didn't help his case out because he told his counsel he was going to hurt him if he argued any mitigating facts. And the court said, you know what, counsel had to either get off the case or had to argue mitigating facts. But the result was that said if we are not comfortable – with what happened here, that there was no mitigating circumstances, and it's clear he would have gotten something else than what he got. So I think the Pote case is a great example for that. I also think, given the character of the Cedar Creek report, it's reasonably probable that a court may alter its primary focus of what the sentence is. When Judge Maroney in the post-conviction report says, no, it doesn't matter, he was going with the assumption that he was staying with the primary concern of the sentence, which was the need to protect the public. If Ms. Harber's character is presented in its entirety, there's a reasonable probability that maybe a sentencing court changes the primary purpose from rehabilitation. Or in this case, if they keep it, protect the public like Judge Maroney did, Judge Barone kind of had the, I'm going to put you in jail for such a long time that you are, will be deterred from ever doing something this foolish again. And it's reasonably probable that a sentencing court may take a look at this and say, instead of putting them in jail for a long period of time to deter them, maybe we need to focus on some type of rehabilitation plan or some type of mental health treatment to protect the public so that this person's needs can be met and treated and then correct their behavior to society's norms.
May I ask, if you are able to prevail here to get a remand, how is it determined who the sentencing judge would be?
I believe it would be remanded back to Milwaukee County and assigned to whomever has taken over Judge Maroney's calendar for this branch.
And you'd have the right to substitute, of course.
Correct. Correct. I know Judge Maroney is no longer on the criminal branch.
And if we were in a single judge county, how would that work?
Well, I guess at that point we would have to, I would assume single judge counties have a procedure that if one judge gets substituted on, a different judge comes in. So I would think it's very similar to that.
But there is a right of substitution?
Sure, whenever a case is reversed and remanded.
I'm sorry, I can't remember, but there's a statute that covers what happens on remand, but I can't remember if it only covers, namely, whether the same judge sits or not. But I thought it would only cover if there's a new trial, but I'll look it up, unless you remember it offhand.
I believe on remand from an appellate court, a defendant is entitled to a substitution.
Right. And then if there's a new judge sitting, you get notice of who the new judge is, and you have a time period within which you can file a substitution.
Correct.
That's the one
I'm thinking. If the appellate court reversed the trial court.
Correct. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney Michael C. Sanders, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Michael Sanders, representing the state of Wisconsin. The state asked this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, which affirmed the decision of the Circuit Court, denying Chantel Harbor's motion for post-conviction relief. Harbor raises two issues. She asserts that information in a post-sentence report is a new factor justifying sentence modification. She also asserts that her trial counsel was ineffective in not presenting the information in the post-sentence report at sentencing. The Circuit Court denied both of these claims. It concluded on the first issue that the information in the post-sentence report did not justify modification of the sentence. On the second issue, it concluded that Harbor can't show prejudice because the information she presented in the post-sentencing report would not have affected the sentence had it been presented at sentencing. The court was right on both counts, and this court should affirm.
Counsel, would it, and I don't mean to ask you an unfair question,
sure,
but I think some of the case law dealing with new factor, and I mean this for defense counsel, if you wish to respond to this on rebuttal, I won't ask again, but it's all over the place on what the test is.
Mm-hmm.
And the language frustrates the purpose of the original sentence, as far as I can tell, only shows up in a court of appeals decision. Are you aware of any Supreme Court case that has adopted that language, or what do you think the new factor test is according to the Supreme Court case law?
Well, I think the frustrates the purpose language was added by the Court of Appeals in Michaels.
Right.
In Crocieri in 2004, this court did deal with that language, and it set out that it was added in Michaels in paragraph 14 of that opinion. It says, see also Michaels, concluding that the new factor standard has been further refined since Rosato as those factors that frustrate the purpose of the original sentence. In that opinion, in the Crocieri opinion, the court later says in paragraph 22, it says, additionally, Crocieri's rehabilitation is not a circumstance that frustrates the purpose of the sentence.
So what do you think the test is, the new factor test?
It's a two-part test. It is a set of facts highly relevant to the imposition of sentence not known to the judge because it was either A, not in existence at the time of sentencing, or B, unknowingly overlooked by all of the parties. It then must be an event or a development which frustrates the purpose of the sentence. Part two is that new factor must warrant or justify modification of the sentence.
So you don't think frustrating the purpose and justifying modification are the same factor?
I'm not exactly sure which part of the test that language would go to.
That's what I'm trying to figure out. If you write the opinion, how do you write what the test is so everybody knows? Because it seems to be a little bit across, all over the place. So is frustrating the purpose different than justifying modification?
Mm-hmm. I expect it would go more towards that prong. In that if it doesn't frustrate the purpose, it might not be something which would justify modification, whereas the first is more what this is, not what it means. Well, so, yeah, I think I would agree that it would go more towards part two. Okay.
Well, you could have, can you not, a new factor fitting sub one, your first thing, that doesn't frustrate the purpose but still justify modification.
I expect you could. I mean, I haven't thought about that in great detail or great depth. Mm-hmm. But I suppose there could be something that doesn't frustrate the purpose that the court had at the time it imposed the sentence.
And right, like public safety.
Could justify a modification if there was something that the court couldn't have possibly thought of at the time.
Right. Still have public safety as its purpose, but maybe fewer years.
I'm sorry.
That so the purpose may be public safety, which it always is, and there may be a new factor that would indicate that a lesser term may be in order, still justifying public safety.
I don't know that I would want to argue that in the exercise of its discretion, a court couldn't find that. Couldn't say, well,
argue.
This
so
doesn't really frustrate what I was doing. However, with this new information that I didn't have at sentencing, I would have had the same
purpose,
objective and purpose, and yet I might have changed the sentence slightly.
Right.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't say that a court couldn't do that, since this is a discretionary standard.
Right. Thank you.
Counsel, as I see the sentencing transcript, and I'm going to focus in on rehabilitation, because I think that the pre-sentence report pushes the idea of rehabilitative needs. I saw twice where the court referenced rehabilitation or the word to rehabilitate, but without any
overt discussion of rehabilitation in the sentencing transcript. The first time the judge referenced it was saying, my job is to protect the public, but of course it's to be concerned about rehabilitation also. I'm paraphrasing, but it's essentially that. And then a little later, he says, I have to consider the character and the rehabilitative needs. Again, I might be paraphrasing, but pretty close. Then he goes on to talk about the character, and yet I don't see any other reference to rehabilitation overtly. Does the court, in your opinion, discuss rehabilitation? The reason I ask the question is this seems to be the import of the pre-sentence. You know, boy, rehabilitation would have been more front and center, or at least an opportunity to consider it, if all of this information were there. And the transcript may or may not reflect that the court considered the rehabilitation. Any thoughts on that or any response to that, counsel?
I don't believe there's a great deal in the transcript of the court discussing rehabilitation. I think that's fair. I don't know in the report if what it says about rehabilitation necessarily says that it would need to be done outside of prison or that it's going to work or anything along those lines. It makes a couple of points that she's actually doing well in while in, that she's been getting treatment for her psychotropic and psychoanalytical mental health treatment, and that she has immersed herself in that treatment. It mentions that it appears likely that her mental health issues and severe drug dependency problems are the core of her crimes, although it doesn't even try to say it actually caused them or say that's why she's done all these crimes. It says she is dedicated to working with psychiatrists, therapists, and alcohol and drug treatment staff while incarcerated and to continue in such treatment when she does return to the community. So I don't know that what it's saying is necessarily that she would need treatment on the outside as opposed to treatment on the inside and then treatment on the outside when she gets out. I think in terms of the rehabilitation, the trial court's post-sentence comments would seem to indicate that while that is one of the things it has to look at, once it understood that she had a lot of past drug problems and a lot of past crimes based on her drug problems, that it was an aggravating factor. And I don't know that it would have, had it more closely looked at the rehabilitative needs, if it would have said, well, and based on that, I think you should get less time or you should have more time outside as opposed to more time inside. So I don't know that the transcript shows that the court really looked at it all that extensively. I don't know that it would have helped if it had.
In a resentencing ordered by an appellate court, is there always a new trial judge?
The defendant has the right to substitute, or can ask for substitution. I have the statute someplace in my things, but I'm not quite sure what statute it is. But yes, I don't think there's any question that she could ask for a new judge. But I think what would be important to think about, though, is that the way that I see the case, what happened is the trial court heard at the sentencing hearing all of the stuff which the two parties argued and what she said, which isn't much. So it knew the basic facts of the case from all of the other parts of the record. It then heard both sides' arguments and imposed sentence. With this report in the post-conviction motion, what the argument seems to be is that with that added to what the court already heard, had all of that come in at the same time, it would have imposed something else. If this goes to a new judge for a new sentencing, all that new judge is going to get is what the court got first and what the court got second. And then it's going to look at them at the same time, but this judge has already done that. It already looked at what it heard first and what it heard second and said, it doesn't matter. What I heard second doesn't change what I heard first. So if the new judge hears that exact same information, I don't know why there's any reason to think that that judge would do anything differently.
Well, sentencing is discretionary, right?
Sure.
And if you had 10, and I've seen exercises with 30 trial judges given the same facts, and they all spread, right? So to say that the second judge will do the same thing as the first judge is not quite accurate.
I don't know that there's any reason to think that the judge isn't going to do the same thing. New judge might not. It might view things differently, but I don't know that a defendant in a claim after having been sentenced has a right to just have a new judge.
Oh, I agree with that. You don't get two out of three. You just don't. You get one sentencing judge, and that sticks unless there's a reason for it not to stick.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. But not every judge in the state would have given this defendant the same sentence.
No, I didn't mean to imply that, if that's what I did.
All right. Good. Thank you.
Sure.
How do you explain that the judge views mental health and physical health and alcohol and drug abuse as mitigating and apply that to this case, and then says that it would be aggravating?
The guideline sheet is not, there are some issues with it.
Okay.
And I don't know what the judge viewed when it filled out the sheet. There are a few checkboxes that I can't really explain. Okay. I think it would be accurate to say, though, that having read the complaint and knowing something about the defendant's history, the judge may have known that she, in the past, has had some issues with drugs and with her mental health. With her drugs, the court knew about her mental health issues because her attorney did bring that up. In terms of the drugs, her attorney didn't bring that up. The court may have known that, but then when the court read this report and saw how extensive her drug past was, and that it is, I don't want to say caused, but has been that it may have affected the crime she has committed, it then found that to be an aggregating factor rather than a mitigating factor. So once it knew more, it may have said, well, now that I know more about this, I'm not going to give her credit for this as a mitigating factor, but actually find that it's an aggravating factor.
Well, you said on page 132, and that's in the original sentencing, right? This is in Mr. Redding's brief.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you here today that as far as extended supervision is concerned as to count one, it's going to be as follows. You're going to have a mental health evaluation and follow whatever treatment is necessary. You're going to have AODA assessment and follow whatever treatment is necessary. You're going to have no controlled substances or alcohol. You shall have urine screens to make sure that that is being accomplished. And then he goes on to restitution and a DNA sample. So he is aware at the original sentencing of a mental health issue, which needs evaluation,
Certainly. And
AODA assessment, and no controlled substances. And I gather he views that as mitigating at that time.
From what the guideline sheet says, yes. I assume so. I don't think there's anything that would lead me to think that that's not true. However, once the court understood the full depth of her problems and of her past, then it may have to actually not be a mitigating factor, but instead an aggregating factor.
Counsel, this is a problem that I have on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And it deals with the lack of a pre-sentence report, either a request at the time of the hearing, or, you know, at the time prior to sentencing, or having your own pre-sentence report on behalf of the defense. As I read the transcript, the argument for sentencing, although there's some back and forth at the very end regarding sentence credit that's unresolved, but not counting that because that doesn't go to the heart of the argument for sentencing. The defense counsel has 14 paragraphs of argument. These are short paragraphs. Some of them are one-sentence paragraphs in the transcript. And he starts out saying, my recommendation is 10, 5, and 5, and I leave it to you whether it's consecutive or concurrent. And I say to myself in reviewing this record, here's someone who is potentially arguing 10, 5, and 5, and can be concurrent or consecutive, so 20 years.
I think what the attorney says is a global recommendation of 10, 5, and 5.
What does that mean?
I think what that would mean is a total of 10 years, 5 and 5. How it's broken down would be up to the court, but in...
Okay, I misread that then. Okay, and so my point is diluted, but nevertheless, let me attempt to make it, okay?
Certainly.
And that is, he's coming in and asking for 10 years. 10 years consecutive or concurrent in terms of global sentence for these three offenses of 10 years in the Wisconsin State Prison System to be broken down to 5 years initial confinement, 5 years extended supervision. We make no recommendation as to concurrent or consecutive, leaving that matter to the court. That's what was said. Okay. But let's take the interpretation that global means capping at 10 years, because that's what you're advancing. Is that correct?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, okay. 10 years. 10 years of someone's life. 10 years of taxpayers' expense. 10 years likely of anything done to effectuate rehabilitation, given the past history here. Maybe efforts, but not too successful. Shouldn't there have been a pre-sentence? Shouldn't someone have asked for a pre-sentence when you have defense counsel asking for 10 years? And it appears to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that the state has kind of rested on recommending a substantial prison term to be consecutive. So that's a lot of years of a person's life. That's a lot of dollars of taxpayers' money. There are 14 paragraphs of argument. And then the file is closed and next case. You know, I don't know. It just seems to me that more should be done. Respond to that if you will. Was it ineffective assistance of counsel not to request a pre-sentence or provide a pre-sentence here?
In this case, no. Because
how about
that
a case
hasn't
very much like this case?
In this case, no, because that claim hasn't been raised. There's no claim that counsel should have asked for a PSI. There's no claim that the trial court erred in not ordering a PSI. In the absence of any argument or anything that would indicate that the court erroneously exercised its discretion in not asking for a PSI, in not ordering a PSI, I don't think there's any basis for the court to conclude that the court erred. I also don't think that there's any basis to conclude that her trial counsel erred in not asking for a PSI because she isn't claiming it. Whether that claim could be raised, I don't know that I'm the best person to ask, but it's not raised. That's not the claim.
What was the exposure here, total exposure possible?
67.5 years.
Pardon me?
67.5 years.
So you've got a defendant who has an exposure of 67.5 years in prison for, what is it, robbery, armed robbery, attempted something or other? Attempted armed robbery. We don't know if she has a gun, if I read this right, but she apparently had a knife. And was so inept that she couldn't write out a note that was legible. So the story goes, right? Yes. And then was arrested because she jaywalked in front of a police car. Is that right?
Yes.
This is not a Dillinger. I mean, okay. from my reading of this and recollection of Dillinger. So, I mean, I'm not saying she's not dangerous. Anyone who attempts robbery or has a knife and shows it, or even if it doesn't show it and has a knife and attempts robbery, that's not to be condoned, nor should it be said that this is not a danger for public safety. But, I mean, we don't have a professional robber here on the basis is exposure of 67 years. And judges give sentences for 40, 50, 60 years, right? And one would think that, and maybe you think she's lucky because what she get, only 10?
24.
20, well, how much?
24.
24. Mm-hmm. When you add them up because they're consecutive.
Yes.
24. So she only got a third of what she might have gotten, roughly.
Yes.
A third. Maybe she came out lucky, but, I mean, the exposure of that number of years would seem to me to require the utmost care providing a sentencing material and a sentencing argument to the judge. Doesn't that seem appropriate to you? Without saying it was ineffective assistance of counsel, because that's not what you should say. But it is odd.
Well, I will start by repeating what I said, that there's no claim that her counsel was not effective for not asking for a PSI, and there's no claim that the trial court erred in not ordering a PSI. So for the purpose of this case, I don't know that there's much that I can say. I would imagine that in most cases where the exposure was this length, the court would order a PSI. But I don't have any statistics that would back that up, that would talk to that. So I don't really know.
Well, at page 19 of Mr. Redding's brief, he talks about deficient in not bringing up all these matters about the defendant, and with a little investigation, counsel's performance fell short in presenting mitigating factors, fell below standards of no investigation of mitigating factors, doesn't say specifically, as I read this, that counsel was ineffective in asking for a PSI, but you don't have to ask for a PSI. You can have a PSI done yourself, which a counsel later did.
Sure.
So,
well,
you
yes.
don't.
It's not. Yes.
So the deficient performance is counsel's deficient performance in failing to investigate and present mitigating facts at Harper's sentencing. Don't have to say it's because they failed to ask the court for a PSI. It's that the counsel failed to get this information to the court one way or another. Isn't that the allegation here or the argument made?
Yes. Okay. I think that is what is in the briefs and in the post-conviction motion. I'm only pointing out that the claim of an actual PSI is not in this case.
Okay. Accepted.
There was no PSI here, but when the court filled out the criminal record part of the check sheet, the court appears to have had quite a bit of information
yes.
about it. Defendant had been convicted of four prior felonies.
Mm-hmm.
And we subsequently learned in the Cedar Creek report that she had been at Techita four previous times.
Mm-hmm.
There were three assaultive felonies.
Mm-hmm.
She was on legal status at the time all three crimes were committed.
I don't know that, you know, I don't know why the court didn't ask for a PSI or why her attorney didn't ask for a PSI, but I think you could argue that her attorney didn't ask for a PSI because there's a lot of really bad stuff. And what came out in this post-sentence report, which is written for her, is a nice spin on things. Even so, it shows some aggregating circumstances. In a true PSI written by someone at DOC, which she didn't pay for, and which isn't trying to put a nice spin on things, we don't really know what exactly may have come out or how the court may have viewed it. So I think that there is a reasonable chance that she actually got less time than she might have gotten had her counsel asked for a PSI.
She entered a plea. Mm-hmm. There must have been a plea colloquy. Do we know who did that?
The same judge.
Okay, so the judge went through mm-hmm. an extensive plea colloquy. Is that in the record?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Okay.
If I can add just a couple of things, opposing counsel spoke of the standard in Smith for determining whether deficient performance resulted in prejudice. I just want to point out that that is a case where there was a plea breach. So in that case and in that type of case, what the judge says isn't taken into account because prejudice is a presumed. So Smith really had that. What Smith says, I don't think helps this case at all. I don't think that's what the court looks at. What it really looks at is there a reasonable probability of a different outcome? And in this case, the most useful, if I can finish, please, is that?
Yes, you may, counsel.
The most useful thing to determine what would have happened at this sentencing hearing, had this new information been given to the court at the hearing, is what the judge says. The judge viewed Part A, now has viewed Part B, and says with Part A and Part B, it wouldn't have changed anything. So not taking that into account just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. There is a case that I wanted to mention, State v. Parrish. It's a 980 case, but it dealt with a post-commitment motion after a bench trial, and the court in that case found that the Court of Appeals affirmed and found that what the trial court found after sentencing or after it entered the commitment order was the best thing to look at to determine what the court would have done had it had more information at trial. That's 258 with second 521. And specifically in in paragraph, I did not write down the paragraphs. Oh, the court said, Parrish provides no legal or logical basis on which we would reject the reasonable conclusion of a post-commitment judge when that judge, by virtue of having been the fact finder at trial, is in the best position to consider whether additional information would have altered his or her commitment decision. And I think it's exactly the same thing here. There wouldn't be any reason not to look at what the judge thought and what the judge wrote in its order denying the motion for post-conviction relief.
What paragraph were you reading from, counsel?
That was in paragraph 41.
41?
Yes, 41.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thank Sanders. You. Redding?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you start, can you tell me on the robbery with threat of force, the attempt in count one, what was the maximum possible exposure?
It was an attempted robbery on count one, I believe.
That's what I said.
I'm sorry. I believe it was 7.5 years.
7.5 of confinement or?
I believe it was broken down into 5 and 2.5.
That's the maximum?
Those were the maximums, correct.
Okay. And count two, the armed robbery with threat of force?
I believe that was 20 years.
Okay. And count three, same, right?
Count three was an actual armed robbery, and so that would have been 40 years.
40, okay. And on count one, she received 3 years of initial confinement, right?
Correct.
Count two, 4 years of initial confinement.
Correct.
And count three, the one for 40 years possible exposure, 5 years of initial confinement, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right, and your argument is that the judge would have imposed less of a sentence had he known what was in the report.
That is my argument for the new factor for the ineffective assistance of counsel. My argument is that the proceeding was fundamentally unfair and a new sentencing hearing should be had.
Thank you.
I want to address the comment, should there have been a PSI? And I want to make it clear that that was never my claim in this case, is that counsel should have requested a PSI. In fact, I think from the point of advocacy, counsel should have been thrilled that the state didn't ask for one and that the court didn't order one so that he can present his own. And what is required is an earnest investigation. And Strickland talks, and Strickland was a sentencing case. And Strickland talks about what an earnest investigation is. And in Strickland, he was found to have been, he did a sufficient job. But the two cases that come much later in Wiggins and Williams, both U.S. Supreme Court cases, it was found that it was not an earnest investigation. So I'm not arguing that, hey, you should have asked for a PSI. What I'm arguing is you needed to make an earnest investigation into the mitigating facts of Ms. Harbor's life, and then you needed to present those to the court. And if there is no state PSI, you can do a very creative job in doing the advocacy, and that's what prong one of Strickland requires.
Counsel, even if there was an earnest investigation, seems to me that you give up the prejudice prong by what you just advanced. By that, I mean you suggest, hey, it's a good idea there wasn't a pre-sentence because it would have been tougher. You know, I mean, good advocacy was dodging that bullet and coming up with one that you can put a little spin on. Well, in prejudice, you've got to show that it made a difference. And your argument seems to be, as I hear it, that the difference would have been it could have been worse. So why don't we fold up our tents and go home? I mean, you are conceding no prejudice? Tell me what I'm not hearing.
I am not conceding prejudice. I was addressing more of the first prong, the prejudice prong.
Efficient
performance prong.
Yeah, but I say, so what if there's no prejudice?
Well, the The prejudice prong then comes down to what about the fundamental fairness and the reliability of these proceedings? And if counsel would have done an earnest investigation into these things, even if there would have been a state PSI, the fundamentalness of advocacy of the proceeding would then change. There's a reasonable probability the court would view Ms. Harbor in a different light. And I believe the Court of Appeals even kind of implies this when it says the court may have had more insight into how Harbor came to be who she is. So again, it's the proceedings themselves that we're concerned about and what was presented about Ms. Harbor's character. So I think both the Wiggins and the Williams case talk about an earnest investigation. The court is correct that rehabilitation was mentioned twice in the sentencing transcript. And it's our position, again, that it shows, I guess, that the court did at least have rehabilitation on their mind. But because nothing was really presented to the court about the rehabilitation of the drug needs, the court never really considered it for the sentencing proceeding. And lastly, I see my time is up.
May make a
sure
short statement, please.
Right. I guess at this point, we're just asking for a, I believe this would have to be sent back for a Mockner hearing. Because there never was a Mockner hearing on ineffective assistance. And we're also asking for the court to find that the Cedar Creek was a new factor and send it down for the court to then review if the sentence is entitled.
So what, you're not asking for resentencing?
We are, but there was not a Mockner hearing done in this case.
So you have to have a Mockner hearing for what purpose, counsel?
My understanding is the Mockner mandates it. Certainly, if this court would like to declare that.
I understand that. But what would the Mockner hearing do here? Give you an opportunity to get counsel in, trial counsel in, and see what the reasoning was?
Correct.
Okay. So it's a Mockner under Strickland?
Correct.
All right.
That is it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both Mr. Redding and Mr. Sanders for their argument in another criminal sentencing case, but with a different twist. And so ends our second case, 09-AP-1252-CR, State versus Chantel T. Harbor. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45. Although the court, for those who may be listening, will check the weather reports to see what should be done tomorrow about oral argument. And Mr. Sanders, you might want to get home quickly. Thank you. And safely. Oh,